Our next presentation comes from Marco Suero Ball, who will be discussing factors in audio extraction. Marcos is co-chair of the ARSC Technical Committee. He is senior archivist at the New York Public Radio, where he often writes about audio preservation issues. Marcos was part of the Collection Management Task Force that drafted the Library of Congress National Preservation Plan in 2012. And in 2011, he co-translated IAZA's TCO4 into Spanish and Catalan. He is a member of the Standards Committee of the Audio Engineering Society and of the Independent Media Arts Preservation Advisory Board. Among other projects, Marcos has mastered and restored Jacqueline Kennedy, Historic Conversations of Life with John F. Kennedy, and he was nominated for a Grammy for his work on Polk Miller and his Old South Quartet. He has worked at MasterDisc Mastering Studios, the Alan Lomax Archives, Columbia University Libraries, Emory University, and the Center for Black Music Research. He teaches audio preservation at the Palmer School of Library Science. Marcos, take it away.
Thank you very much. Boy, that was too long. Good to be here in Pittsburgh. Thank you for coming. I'm going to be flying through these slides because I have a lot of slides and a lot of material to cover. What I'm hoping to present today is a conceptual framework upon which we can hang data to sort of quantify some of the challenges we're facing as audio archives. So just to give you a little background, I work at the New York Public Radio Archives. New York Public Radio includes WNYC, which is a public radio station, and WQXR, which is a classical radio station. Our collection is quite heterogeneous. The stations go back to 1924, and that means there's a lot of different formats. We have pretty much everything except cylinder and wire. In various locations, we do a lot of repatriation, so it's not unusual in our world, but here's our best-kept materials are in climate-controlled, compact shelving on-site, but there's also off-site, and again, a lot of repatriation going on all the time. Here's another set of collection. These are about 13,000 lacquer discs, 16-inch lacquer discs. They're housed in a municipal archive storage room in Brooklyn, and not temperature or humidity controlled, unfortunately. So when I started working in a broadcasting environment and trying to deal with the issues that we all face, I started thinking about conceptual framework. How can we quantify some of the issues that we face? And I realized that audio archives are very similar to broadcasters in a sense. There's some information we want to convey, and there's a channel through which we convey that information. And that channel usually has some kind of noise. And noise, I don't mean like hiss, which is kind of Gaussian noise or anything like that, but described as a modification of that original information. In the case of broadcaster, the channel is spatial. I'm broadcasting from here, and someone at a distance away gets that information in a more or less accurate form. In the case of archives, it's usually a temporal channel. In other words, there's a carrier that carries it through time. And these concepts inevitably led me to Claude Shannon and information theory. And this is a classic schematics of Claude Shannon's breakthrough paper on information theory, in which he defined what a binary digit is, the basic unit of information, and how communication systems work, basically. And in our case, this is usually the archivist domain, right? We're trying to present information as accurately as possible. And unfortunately, unlike broadcasters, we don't have much control over how that was recorded, so it's sometimes very hard to quantify how that information has changed. So I compare it to, you have a receiver at home, you have control over how good the receiver is, you have no control over the reception of that signal, or you have some control, but you have no idea how well recorded or how well broadcast that signal has been. So this is my modification to that schematics. There's an archivist, there's a patron, there's a received signal, and you want to make your patron happy, of course. And because my background is in engineering, that's the point, that transduction there is the point that I'm particularly interested about. All engineers know that changes in format are usually the weak points of any transmission system. And that usually means, for example, digitizing or any kind of reformatting. But it also includes things like metadata and changing one type of metadata to another metadata. So I'm going to postulate that there's basically two factors that affect the health of a signal recorded, and that's the inherent information at a particular time, and how many resources you have, the amount of resources you have to extract that information, which is something that Claude Shannon alluded to, but not specifically. So, and then how those two things vary over time. So the first thing is how does information change over time? Well, in classic information theory, there's a channel that carries information, and if you have enough bandwidth, you can have what Claude Shannon says, arbitrarily low errors, meaning you can carry that information and you can do it exactly, you can present it exactly as it was recorded. Almost all channels are imperfect, so eventually that information starts getting chopped off, and you can see, you know, as the arrow goes along, it starts losing bandwidth, and that's how you lose information. So we can say in very general terms, and I'm going to speak very generally, sorry, I have some data, but not very reliable at this point, you can say that information is lost over time. And as a point of comparison, here's things that other disciplines have done, and this is how different dyes in textiles fade over time. There's surprisingly little research in our field of how the information is being lost over time. Now let's look at information versus resources. This is potentially how I view it. The more information you have, sorry, the more resources you have, the more accurately you can extract that information. And that means that if you spend, you know, 20 hours transcribing a disk, potentially you should have better information than if you spend 5 minutes. And that seems to be the case. My next slide shows that top line a little fuzzy, because in some of these transductions, particularly in some things like analog mechanical media, there are interpretations. It's a bit like a translation. You know when you read a good translation, but you're not sure how accurate it is. And a translation is another type of transduction that we're not sure about. But interestingly, there's also a minimum amount of resources that you have, that you need. In other words, to transcribe a disk, you need a turntable. To transcribe a tape, you need a particular format, as Jim exhibited very clearly earlier. You need the particular medium and particular training that you need to extract those resources. So let's talk about how those resources change over time, specifically the minimum resources. By the way, that's a picture of BASF in the late 1940s. So that just shows you that at one point tape was a big deal. So this is the area that goes into economics, and I cannot claim that I understand economics much. And if I could predict markets, I probably wouldn't try to make a living in audio archiving. But I have some cute pictures. And this is what economists call the waves of dominant design. And we're all familiar with that. We're talking about obsolescence, basically. And we're obviously past CDs. And here's another one that I find more interesting in a way, because it's per capita spent on these carriers, which means that actually, as a society, we seem to have cared more about CDs than we care about digital music, and in fact, it's going down. Part of it, of course, is the amount of material that there is out there, but yeah, I find that interesting. As a society, we seem to care less. The result of that, of course, is obsolescence, as we know, and it seems logical to assume that the curve that we're interested in is the inverse of that curve. In other words, you're going to need more resources to even play back anything over time as the market gets changes over time. Of course, there's two forces at work. One is the supply and demand, the forces, which means that the less demand, the materials may be cheaper. The other one is there's an attractiveness to oligopolies. Basically, when you are the only game in town, there's good reasons to stay in that game because why not? You're already there, and there's no reason why you should abandon it. It can be quite profitable. So let's put all these together. This is information, time, and resources. Let's say we have a material that was created at a certain time, and if we extracted it at that time, we played it back on that day, which usually is what happens in broadcasting or very close to that day. This is the amount of information you would get. If we try to do it today, the extraction today, the information that you get is considerably less for two reasons. One is that the information itself has eroded over time, at which rate we don't know yet. But the other is that because the minimum resources are higher, you actually get less percentage of the remaining information that's in that carrier. So let's look at some case studies. We are having big problems with CDRs in our station. These are very preliminary numbers. Don't really trust these numbers, but this is what we appear to be seeing. So in other words, the information encoded in our silver CDRs seems to be suffering tremendously and seems to have this kind of curve. But even if you did a linear curve, it's pretty dramatic. And again, these are not, I was very careful not to put any data there yet, but it's kind of bad. I will tell you that none of our CDRs pass the YASA test of 220 blur. So let's look at extraction of silver CDRs. Thank goodness, extraction of CDRs, as we all know, can be pretty fast. And even at very high speeds, you can get pretty much the same information as you would in real time. And then prices are interesting because over the course of its history, CD playback systems have become actually cheaper. So we're in good shape there. It doesn't really matter that much to us. What that means in the end is that, you know, we have an urgent problem because no matter how cheap the player is, the media itself is decaying at an alarming rate. Speaking of alarming rates, let's look at lacquer discs. We estimate that we probably lost between 1% and 5% of our lacquer discs catastrophically. And when you average that, that means, you know, you've over approximately 40 years, you've lost not only 5% of the discs overall, but if you average it out, that means you're losing 5% of information in your disc, and that manifests itself in things like decay and additional palmitic acid and additional lacquer issues. In terms of extraction versus information or integrity of information, there seems to be an S-curve. For example, if you clean the disk, you get it doesn't take that much time, but the improvement in things, you can measure things like surface noise is considerable. And then, as you know, I've been working on stylus selection a little bit as well, and it seems like past a certain number of styli, you're not going to get much better results. In other words, if you test 10 styli, you're going to get, you know, a certain degree of fidelity. If you test with 20 styli, you may not get that much that much more of an improvement on average. And then interestingly, these are numbers for some of the, inflation adjusted for some of the first playback systems, mechanical playback systems, which cost more or less $4,000 for a household. And I compare the prices of the, not that it's an archival machine, but it's hard to find historical prices for some of these things. But the Thorens to D160, which is a machine that plays 78s. And interestingly enough, it's actually more expensive now than just 10 years ago. And I suspect it's because of demand, actually, because vinyl is hot now. But it was interesting that it actually doubled in price in the last 10 years. So that's interesting. And my last case study is digital audio tape. There's a study from Belgium of de Klerk, Brecht de Klerk, and he found actually very few errors in their also broadcasting station. And we did a pretty medium-sized ripping, actually, of that, and we found actually less than 1%, so they're actually physically in good shape. He found about 1% errors in his tapes. They were from 1992. And in our case, we did 24,000 minutes, and we found two errors, so really, really low error rate. So it's actually pretty good. We ripped them at double speed, and we seem to be getting comparable results. After we did it, there's been concerns about the ripping mechanism, so we're doing them in real time now. But that seems to be, the curve seems to be something like that. And in terms of the price has actually dropped too. And it's not just the price of the machines, of course, there's a whole infrastructure that goes with this, which would affect how this curve looks. But we seem to be also in pretty good shape with that. And of course, technologies may change the game. And Irene is very different from the Arcaphone, from the gramophone. At one point, we had basically no way of playing cylinders without compromising their integrity. So that could be a factor, too. So in other words, this is a conceptual framework that I hope we can add data to. So know thy enemy, that's my call to arms, and document, quantify, pamper your originals, and especially share as we embark, several institutions here embark, and vendors on these big digitization projects. I think we can all learn from the data that comes out of those projects. I post occasionally on our blogs for WNYC. If you do WNYC archives blogs, it'll come up. This was a post that I did basically paraphrasing this presentation from a couple of years ago. And there's another one for style selection and what some of the issues with that. And that's it. Thank you very much. Be happy to take any questions.
You mentioned you did DAT tapes at double speed. Are you using like a data drive of some kind rather than a DAT machine?
Yeah, DAT to wave, yeah.
And then DAT to wave? Mm-hmm. And that's giving you that kind of, that's quite good numbers for DAT restoration.
Yeah, I mean, our DATs, I should make a big caveat, thanks for bringing it up, because your mileage may, and in fact, will vary. our DATs were recorded on professional machines. They've been very well taken care of. They were in a broadcasting station. But the same could be said of the CDRs, for example, and we're seeing catastrophic failures. Those CDRs were probably, they're Redbook CDRs, and they were we think were mostly recorded on a standalone machine, and yeah, we've seen all kinds of crazy errors. So you win some, you lose some.
Hey, Marcus.
Hey, Tom.
With DATs, have you had any that you've had to bake? And if so, how did that go for you?
Sorry, I'm knocking on wood. No. No.
All right, any other questions? Great, thanks again, Marcus. Really, really great.